Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is June the 14th, and we are in Parshas Chukas, which we began last week. We read through the entire first part of Chukas, which dealt with the Parah Aduma, with the red cow, the red heifer. And tonight, we're going to continue that discussion, and there are two broad points that we need to discuss. Most likely we'll cover one tonight and one next week. One is the details of how the Parah Aduma worked. What exactly was done, what happened historically, and second is the deeper meaning behind the Parah Aduma. Some of the details we covered last week, some of the details of how it works, and tonight we're going to cover it in more detail. And we may repeat some of the things we said last week, but it'll be in more detail. Now, the Parah Aduma, as was mentioned, is for Tumas Meis. It's for someone who becomes Tamei because of contact with a dead body, a human being. There are many, many details and rules about becoming Tamei from a dead body. The details are clearly going to be very relevant once the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, speedily and in our days. But right now, we're only going to give a general overview of how that works. Most people understand that if someone touches a dead body, they become tamei. Most people also understand if one is in a room with a dead body, they also become tamei. That is called tumas ohel. Ohel means a tent. And someone is in a room with the dead body, they become tamei. This is the main reason why when people attend a funeral, they become tamei. In Atlanta, funerals are almost always graveside. But typically, funerals are done in a building. And when one is in a building with a dead body, in a room with a dead body, then they become tamei. Even if it's a very large auditorium, but they're in the same room, sometimes even the same building, but at least the same room as the dead body, then they become tamei. Likewise, one goes to a graveyard, a Jewish graveyard, then one becomes Tamei. Now, there's also Tumas Meis with non-Jews, with people who are non-Jewish who have passed away, but the rules are slightly different, and we're not going to deal tonight with those differences. There are some differences there. But for tonight, we'll focus on if the person who passed away is Jewish. So, when one attends a funeral, either because they're in the same building, under the same tent, the same awning, as a dead body, or in the graveyard, or if one does a tahara and touches a dead body, one becomes tamei meis. There are other ways one can become tamei meis, even if one sometimes in battle, in war, when one person kills another person, they can become tamei through that. It can happen that way as well. So there are a lot of details in regard to this. When one is tamei meis, one is tamei for a minimum of 7 days. At the end of 7 days, they go to the mikvah, and then they can become tahar like any other tumah. They go to the mikvah, they wait for nightfall, and then they can become tahar. However, with tamei meis, in addition to going to the mikvah, one does need to get the ashes of the Parah Aduma sprinkled on them. And that's the discussion in Parshas Chukas here of Parah Aduma. The ashes of the Parah Aduma are mixed with water. That is then sprinkled on the person on the 3rd day and on the 7th day from when they became tamei. And then they can become tahar. The Parah Aduma, as we mentioned last week, is not a karban, although it follows some of the rules of a karban. It's not allowed to have a blemish, a mum, just like any other karban. But it is, in fact, not a karban. In fact, the Parah Aduma actually has rules that you don't find with any other karban, meaning that it's in certain ways it's more stringent than other karbanos. Where all karbanos, all animal karbanos, cannot have a mum, they can't have a blemish, which is true with the Parah Aduma as well. But in addition to that, the Parah Aduma must be all red, obviously. And as we mentioned last week, that means it cannot have two non-red hairs. Two non-red hairs would render it no good. So that means the entire body of the cow has to be checked to make sure all the hairs are red. And in addition to that, it says in the Pasuk, Ashalo Allah Allah Ol, that a yoke did not go upon it, which means that no work can be done with it. It cannot be harnessed to pull something. It cannot be, you can't have somebody ride on it. Things of that nature would render it pasul. Once work is done with the Parah Aduma, it is forever after no good to be used as a Parah Aduma. So a Parah Aduma, which is very, very valuable, it's so rare, and the rules that make it kosher are so broad, that if one has a Parah Aduma born into his flock, one is going to be very, very careful with it, not to allow it to be worked, at which case it would become pasul. The Parah Aduma, as we mentioned last week, though, has a very significant kula, a very significant leniency. That leniency is that normally with a karban, anybody handling a karban has to be completely tahar, has to be completely pure. If you want to bring any karban to the Beis HaMikdash, you have to be pure, you have to be tahar. The kohanim who handle it have to be completely tahar. But with Parah Aduma, there's a leniency in that the Parah Aduma does not need to be, the people involved with it do not need to be completely pure. They can be what is called a Tvul Yom. We mentioned this last week as well. A Tvul Yom means someone who went to the mikveh today, but the sun has not yet set after they went to the mikveh. Normally, when a person is Tomei, and for any Tumah, not just Tumah Smeis, not just for a dead body, but any Tumah, a person goes to the mikveh, and from the time they go to the mikveh until the sun sets, they are in the status of Tevul Yom, which means they went to the mikveh that day, but the sun has not yet set. So there are some restrictions on someone who is a Tevul Yom. A Parah Aduma is not one of those restrictions. A person who is a Tevul Yom is allowed to handle a Parah Aduma. The problem is that the Tzedukim, as we mentioned last week, they understood that a Tevul Yom is not allowed to handle a Parah Aduma, and therefore, to show that the Tzedukim are wrong, when they process the Parah Aduma, they would deliberately make the Kohen Tameh, the day he was going to be involved with the Parah Aduma, he would go to the mikvah, and before the sun would set, he would be involved with the Parah Aduma. So they would therefore act in somewhat of a cavalier fashion with the Tumah of a person being involved in a Parah Aduma. And because of that, there are many, many, many stringencies that offset this leniency. Many, many stringencies. And we're going to discuss many of them tonight. Now, over the years, how many Parah Adumas have been done? One Parah Aduma actually lasts a very, very, very long time. You get a lot of ashes from one Parah Aduma, and we'll explain why it's not just the cow itself, as we'll explain as we go through the process of how a Parah Aduma works. So there is there's a lot of ashes that are produced, and therefore one Parah Aduma can last for many, many years, many generations, in fact. So how many Parah Adumas were there? The very first one was done by Moshe Rabbeinu. He processed a Parah Aduma. He did it. The next one, it seems, was done by Ezra HaSofer, which means at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, which would mean that the ashes from Moshe Rabbeinu's Parah Aduma lasted throughout all the time of the Shoftim in Eretz Yisrael and throughout the first Beis HaMikdash, and it wasn't until the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash that a new Parah Aduma was needed and processed. That would be around 900 years later, maybe even longer than that. And so the Moshe Rabbeinu's Parah Aduma lasted a very, very, very long time. I don't know if that is a miraculous thing, because it was something that Moshe Rabbeinu did, and therefore it had a greater staying power, or the Jews didn't need it as much. Unclear to me exactly what the reason is. You would think the need for a Parah Aduma would be proportional to how many people you have, because people die. That's a natural way of life, is that people die, and therefore there's going to be a need for Parah Aduma. So I'm not sure why that's the case, that Moshe Rabbeinu's Parah Aduma lasted so long. But Ezra HaSofer did the second Parah Aduma. After Ezra HaSofer, there were seven more Parah Adumas done throughout the 420 years that the second Beis HaMikdash was in existence. There were some famous names that perhaps you're familiar with who did process paradumas. Shimon HaTzadik, the Gemara tells us, the Mishnah tells us, processed two paradumas. Yochanan Kohen Gadol processed two paradumas. So those are some famous names. There were three other ones besides those four, and the one that Ezra did as well. Those are the paradumas. So nine in all paradumas throughout history have been done, and the tenth one, I don't know if it'll be the last one, but there'll be a tenth one, of course, when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. We're going to need it again, and it will be processed then. But it lasts, as I said, a very, very, very long time. The paraduma is, the reason why it lasts so long is because when they process the paraduma, they take the paraduma up to Har HaMishcha, which is a mountain to the east of Yerushalayim, and they dig a pit, not a pit as in a deep pit, but a wide area, which is going to be the place where they're going to slaughter and then burn the paraduma. So they first slaughter the paraduma. Blood is thrown, the way the Torah explains to us, that the Kohen sprinkles seven times. He throws blood towards the Beis HaMikdash, which is from where he's standing. He processes it towards the Beis HaMikdash, towards the west. He sprinkles the blood. And then the paraduma is burned. It's burned there in that pit. That's where it's burned. He has to throw into the fire, he has to throw in a cedar wood and hyssop and shnitalas and wool that is dyed red. That gets thrown into the fire. And the final product, meaning after the entire thing is burned, all the ashes that come from the cow itself, the items that were thrown into the fire, and the wood that was used to burn the paraduma, all of those ashes are gathered together, and that they become the ashes of paraduma. All those ashes are acceptable for use for paraduma. So you see that from one cow, a cow anyway is a huge animal, but beyond that you have to deal with the wood used to burn it, which is also going to create a lot of ashes. And all those ashes, sometimes they need to be pulverized after the burning is done, but whatever it is, those, all of that together are going to be the ashes of the paraduma. Each paraduma that was processed was divided up. There were three parts to it. I don't believe these were equal divisions, but there were three places where the paraduma was kept. Some of the paraduma ashes were kept on Har HaMishcha. They had a place there on the mountain where they stored the ashes from previous paros aduma. Some of it was given to the Kohanim to be used for anybody who needs it. And then the Torah says that some of it should be put away l'mishmeres, for guarding, which means for safekeeping. And that's not the one that were on Har HaMishcha, that was in the Beis HaMikdash itself. They were put away for safekeeping. Now we already know from Parshas Beshalach, and we haven't looked in the Chumash at all yet, but we know... I'm sorry, that's a mistake. I jumped the gun over here. We know the Torah tells us that you're supposed to put away some of the ashes, l'mishmeres. Let's look in Parshas Chukas just so you can see that pasuk. The Torah tells us, the pasuk says in pasuk on 840, page 840, pasuk test verse 9, it says at the end of that pasuk, v'haysala das b'nei Yisrael l'mishmeres. It will be for the congregation of the Jewish people for safekeeping. Some of the ashes were put away for safekeeping, meaning they were not used. They were just put away for safekeeping. Some were put on Har HaMishcha, as I mentioned, on the mountain, and the rest, the bulk of it, was used to make people tahar. Now, to make people tahar, those ashes are then mixed with water, and that mixture of water and ashes are sprinkled on the people. Well, if you got all these ashes, and you mix it with water, then you've expanded out even further the volume of what you have. And you don't process it. You don't take all the ashes and mix it with water. What you do is you take some ashes as needed, mix them with water, and sprinkle. The rest of the ashes, which last for years and years and years, ashes don't They don't spoil. They're just ashes. So ashes will last for generations. So the ashes are just kept. And whenever they need to use it, they take some ashes, mix it with water, and that becomes the formula until that runs out. And then they take more ashes and mix it with water. So there's an ongoing supply of ashes to mix with water, and it's sprinkled on the people. How much water needs to touch you if you're a Tameh? So we said on the third day and on the seventh day, you have to get sprinkled with Parah Aduma, water with ashes. How much has to touch you? One drop. That's it. You don't need a whole bunch. You don't get splashed with it. It's just like, you just get touched with it, and you're good. And now, on the other hand, it's not just people that need the Parah Aduma ashes. Utensils that have become Tameh through mace, through a dead body. Also, if you want to make them tar, you don't have to make them tar for everything, but if you need to or want to make them tar, they would also need the Parah Aduma, this formula of the ashes with the water to make them tahar. When they were ready to do a Parah Aduma, so they're running low on ashes, it's time to process a new one, and Baruch Hashem, they have found a Parah Aduma in somebody's flock, they've checked it, every single hair is red, or there's only one non-red hair. They pay an exorbitant price to the owner of the cow, and now the Beis HaMikdash owns this Parah Aduma, and now they want to process it. Well, in order to process it, as I mentioned, there's chumrah upon chumrah upon chumrah, there's stringency upon stringency upon stringency. First of all, the Kohen Gadol, who is going to process the Parah Aduma, is separated from not only his family, but from all people. He's isolated, he's quarantined in the Beis HaMikdash for 7 days. 7 days he is isolated from everybody else. This is in order for the Kohen to be absolutely sure that he is completely Tahar. You'll ask me, yeah, but I thought a Kohen is not allowed to become Tameh to a dead body. That's true. But maybe, it happened, and he didn't realize it. Therefore, we separate him from everybody, and during those 7 days, we sprinkle on him from the Parah Aduma ashes. Not just on the third and seventh day, but we do it every day, except for Shabbos. We do it every day, and we sprinkle on him from all the previous Parah Aduma ashes that have been stored on Har HaMishcha on the mountain. Those are sprinkled on this coin for 7 days. And during that time, he is in isolation. And when it's over, he goes to the mikvah. And now he is ready to process the Parah Aduma. In order to get this coin, we're trying to make absolutely certain that this coin who's going to process the Parah Aduma is without question tahar. Now, there's always a fear, and the fear is called kever hatehom. Kever means grave. Tehom, as we have in Parashas Bereishis, means the depths. The depths. The deep. What's the concern? The concern is that the world's been around for nearly 6,000 years, and you don't really know what's under your feet. Who knows what's down there? Who knows what's going on the ground that you're walking? Since the beginning of time. Who knows? Maybe there's a dead body down there. Somewhere. All the way down. How do you know? You have no idea. And nobody knows. That's called kever hatehom. The grave of the depths. Now normally, we're not so worried about this. Because why do you assume there is a dead body down there? Who says there is? Why should you assume there is? But in this case, we're super, super machmer. We're super stringent. And we are concerned that perhaps there's a dead body down there. Therefore, the Kohen, when he is sequestered in the Beis HaMikdash, the entire Beis HaMikdash is built on kippin, on stilts. Not just the Beis HaMikdash, we're talking about the entire complex of the Har HaBayis, the entire Beis HaMikdash complex, with all its stones, etc., are built with a space between the ground and the floor. What do I mean by that? The way Tumah works, I'm talking about Tumas Mace, the way it works is that the Tumah naturally goes straight up in the air. That's why if there's a dead body beneath your feet, even if it's 100 feet below ground, you become Tumah, because the Tumah goes straight up in the air. If you're in a room with a dead body, the way to conceptualize it is, I'm not standing over the dead body, the dead body is a few feet away from me, but the Tumah goes up from the dead body, hits the ceiling, and then spreads out in the room, and I become Tumah. That's the way to conceptualize it. So, if I'm walking over an area where there's a dead body, then I become Tumah. Even if it's way, 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 many feet below the ground, doesn't make a difference. It makes me Tumah. This is also an issue with once the Tumah gets up into the airspace, it just goes all the way up. And therefore, you have an issue with a plane flying over a graveyard. That can be an issue as well, because the Tumah goes straight up in the air and would hit the plane and everybody in it. So that can be an issue as well. The way you stop Tumah is that you have in a space, an ohel. And that will stop the Tumah. If the dead body's in the room, for example, the Tumah will go up, and as I mentioned, it'll hit the ceiling. It will not go through the ceiling. It will stop there and spread out. What type of thing will do that? What will prevent the Tumah from going up and out? An area that is a tefach by a tefach by a tefach. You need a space of a hand breadth that is just airspace. And that will prevent the Tumah from going out. So if the dead body is buried in some sort of a pit in the ground, and there is the dirt is somehow there's some sort of space between the dead body and the area above it, there's a cavity, there's an area of airspace, the Tumah will go into that airspace, spread out in that airspace, and stop. Provided that the airspace is a tefach big, that there's a tefach by a tefach by a tefach of airspace over the dead body. So the when they built the entire structure, the entire complex of the Har HaBayis, of the Beis HaMikdash, they built it where there would be a space between the ground and the floor of the stone floor of the entire Beis HaMikdash complex. So the Tumah, if there is Tumah down there, it goes up, it goes into this airspace, it spreads out in the airspace, it's like a crawl space, but will not go through. And that's how they prevent the entire Beis HaMikdash complex from becoming Tumah, Tumas Meis, even if there would be a dead body down there, because of Kever HaTehom, the unknown, perhaps unknown body that may be down there. That's the process. That's what they do. So the Kohen Gadol, when he's in the, or the, it doesn't have to be the Kohen Gadol, when the Kohen is in the Beis HaMikdash and he's been sequestered for 7 days, he is in this area that we know that the Tumah will not get to, no matter what. Now, that's fine. We have to get him from there to Har HaMishcha, to the mountain. So we'll talk about that later. But first, what about getting the ashes of the previous Paros Aduma and sprinkling them on the Kohen? And what about the water that is mixed with those ashes? The water must be Mayim Chayim. Mayim Chayim means water that comes from an underground spring. So that water has to be collected. So they would have to have some method of getting that water. And in getting that water, how do you do it if anybody goes to get the water? The person who goes to get the water may be Tumah or may get Tumah by going over Kever HaTehom. And therefore, what they want is, they want someone who for sure has never become Tumah, Tumas Meis, their entire life. No question about it. So you'll say, well, then use another coin. But again, another coin is not supposed to become Tumah, but maybe he did and didn't realize. We need people who definitely never became Tumah. Well, who's that? Well, that's why they had, believe it or not, women, mothers, who were ready to give birth, and they would go to the complex of the Beis HaMikdash, not the Beis HaMikdash itself, but in areas off of the complex of the Beis HaMikdash. That's where they would birth their children, and the children would be raised on that complex, never to set foot off that complex until they are old enough to be able to be involved in processing a para aduma, meaning old enough to enable the Kohen who is being quarantined to become tahar. How do you do that? When it's time for the Kohen, and remember, this doesn't happen in every generation, so you would always have these children around who were fit to do this job. Many of them never did the job because it wasn't necessary while they were children. Once they got to a certain age, they left, and there were new children in the pipeline who were, you know, in that same system, in that same kindergarten, if you will, in the Beis HaMikdash area. And the children, when it was time to get the water, they would get up on the back of a large animal. This large animal would have a wide back, so that way the child could sit on top of the animal. If you think about it, if there's tumah underneath the animal, the belly of the animal is more than a tefach off the ground. So the tumah will go up, hit the belly of the animal, and spread out underneath the animal, but will not go through to the top of the animal. And therefore the child on top will be safe. They put a big board on top of the animal, a flat board, and the child would sit on top, or children would sit on top of that board, so that they would not in any way lean over the edges and become possibly tameh. That animal will be led down to the water. When they got to the waterway, the child would climb off of the back of the animal, down into, the water was not deep, an underground spring comes up from the ground and then it bubbles along, it could be like a creek, so the child would go down into the creek. We're not concerned that there's a dead body beneath the creek bed, that would be highly unlikely. The child fills up the water that's necessary, gets back up onto the back of the animal, and goes back to the Beis HaMikdash area, successfully having procured this water that we now know for sure is completely tahar. It is mixed with the ashes of the para saduma that have been on Har HaMishcha, on the mountain, ever since they were done, all the other para aduma ashes, and then that is sprinkled on the Kohen for 7 days. When that is all over, now it's time to actually process the para aduma. The Kohen, with the para aduma is kept in the Beis HaMikdash area, so the Kohen and the para now take the trip, it's not far, from the Beis HaMikdash to Har HaMishcha. How do they get there? How do they do it in a way that they won't become tameh, or the Kohen won't become tameh? An animal that's alive cannot become tameh, but the Kohen could. What do? So there was a bridge. There was a bridge that was built from the Beis HaMikdash to Har HaMishcha. The bridge was built as follows. There was a lower bridge that was built, and a bridge has columns every so often to hold up the bridge, pillars underneath the bridge to hold it up. And then there was a second bridge built on top of the first bridge, and the pillars of the second bridge were not directly over the pillars from the first bridge. So here's your first bridge with a pillar going up till here. Now you're going to have your second bridge on top of it. The pillar holding up to the second bridge would not be placed directly over the first bridge pillar, but rather it will be offset. Why? Because if you have the pillars one on top of the other, if there is a dead body directly beneath one of the pillars, that tumah has no airspace. It will go directly up through the first pillar, through the second pillar, all the way up to the area right above the second pillar. The Kohen walks over that area, he becomes tameh. And so they would be off-center, so that way, wherever the Tumah was, it would hit an airspace area and get blocked, and it would not make the Kohen Tameh. And the Kohen would, this bridge would go from the Beis HaMikdash area to Har HaMishkan, to the mountain where the Kohen needed to be to process the Parah Adumah. So you hear all of these layers upon layers upon layers of different chumras, different stringencies that offset what they did next, which is they made the Kohen Tameh. After all that, all the quarantining and all of this craziness, I don't want to say the, but you understand what I'm saying. All of this over the top stringency, more strict than anything you've ever heard of with Pesach. Just unbelievable how chamor, how stringent it is. And with all of that, they would then make the Kohen Tameh. Why'd they make him Tameh? Because that's the point. They need to show that the Tzedukim are wrong and that he can become Tameh, not Tameh Meis. They would make him Tameh with a sheretz, with a rodent, a dead rodent. And then he would go to the mikvah right away. There was a mikvah there on Har HaMishcha, on the mountain. And then that same day he would process the Parah Adumah. As we mentioned last week, in processing the Parah Adumah, all those who are involved with it become Tameh. They don't become Tameh Meis. They don't need the Parah Adumah to get out of the Tumah. They just need the mikvah, but they do become Tameh. The Kohen who burns it, the Kohen who gathers it together, the Kohen who throws the items into the fire, all the different Kohanim involved in the processing of the Parah Adumah become Tameh, and they need to go to the mikvah. After it's all burned, then, as we mentioned, it's divided into its three parts, and now you have Parah Adumah ashes that can be mixed with water and last for a very long time, as needed by the Jewish people. Let me pause here, take any questions on this process of the Parah Adumah.
Why would a woman birth at Har
Habayis? That's the question?
Yes.
Yeah, so that was in order that the children would most certainly not be Tameh. So the women would give birth in the complex of Har HaBayis, where it was certain that there was no Tumah because it was built with a space between the ground and the floor, and that way the children would for sure be tar when they went to get the water to mix with the ashes.
Would the mother stay with them?
I imagine the mothers would stay with them. Someone had to stay with them.
And this is especially because they wanted to do this?
Apparently, yes. Apparently, yes. It does not seem, from the Mishnah, it does not appear that it was difficult to find volunteers to do this. It does not appear that they had a shortage of children to do it. That's what it seems. Now, you didn't know that it was going to happen in your day. Could be they wouldn't need a Parah Adumah in your day. Or it could be they saw that the ashes were running low and they started to put out ads asking women who were ready to give birth if you would like this to do this, to be in the Beis HaMikdash area for the next few years with your child. So that's most likely what happened. As the supply was dwindling, then they started to get children to be born there.
Does this only play to Tino?
Excuse me?
Does this only go up to age 13? At 13,
it would be even younger than that. It would be even younger than that. It would be probably, if it's a boy, it's probably under 9 years old.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Rabbi, I had a question.
Yeah.
How much ash to water?
Not much. It has to be enough. That's a good question. It has to be enough that you can see the ashes. Let me see if Rashi says it here explicitly. It has to be enough you can see the ashes in the water, but it's not thick. The final product is not a mush. The final product is liquid. So it's not that much ashes to water. Let me just see if he says here anything explicit. I don't see it off the top here. But anyway, yeah, it was not a lot of ashes per water. It wasn't a minuscule amount, but it was the final product was definitely a liquid, not a solid by any stretch. Anything else?
You hear me?
Yes.
If the body is buried in a box, would that suffice to prevent the tumor from going above it?
That's a good question. If the body is buried in a box, will that prevent the tumor from going above it? In theory, yes, if there is a space of a tefach between the body and the top of the box. In theory. Now,
when it comes to an airplane, wouldn't the luggage compartment underneath the airplane be enough to prevent it?
Okay, that's an excellent question. Good. So really, not just the luggage space underneath, but even the fact that there's a huge amount of space between the ground and the bottom of the plane, so that should be when it hits the bottom of the plane, it should stop right there, because you've got this whole airspace underneath the plane, and that should be enough to stop the tumor from going up, and anybody in the plane should be safe. The reason, this is a little bit of a technical point, but the reason why it's an issue is because there's something called an ohel zaruk. Ohel zaruk means an ohel that moves. Zaruk means thrown, but it means a moving ohel. A moving ohel, according to many opinions, does not stop tuma. And since the plane is moving, therefore it would not stop the tuma because it's an ohel zaruk. Now, I mentioned to you before that the animal with a child on top does stop the tumah. But that's because the animal is walking along the ground. It's not in the air. It's not flying. It's not being thrown. It's got its feet on the ground. So even though, yes, it is moving, but it is not floating in the air or flying through the air. But something flying through the air, that, according to many opinions, will not stop the tumah. And that's why the plane can be a problem. And that's why you have these issues with planes flying over graveyards. And there was an issue once in Eretz Yisrael about it. But maybe it still is a problem. But that's the issue with the Kohanim on those planes. When we bury a person, we attempt, it is best for the body to be in direct contact with the ground, with the dirt. You see, that's good. That's a good thing for the deceased, for the body to decompose quickly, that the ground should be in contact with the body. So that's why in some places, if possible, they bury without a coffin at all. And in the United States, where a coffin must be used, of course, we use the type of coffin that is very easily decomposed, a pine box, etc., so that it will decompose quickly. So we don't rely on any air spaces. Now, it used to be that we'd bury in underground caves. The Gemara refers to them as kuchen, underground caves. That's what they would use to bury. A family would have a family plot. It would be under the ground, and that plot would. What happens is if you were going to your family plot, there would be like a slope into the ground, and as you slope down into the ground, then it opened up into a large cave. You went into the cave, and in the walls of the cave were areas to place dead bodies, long and narrow areas for people to be buried. And that was buried because it's under the ground. So that's what they would do. So sometimes they would build them in a way that there would be airspace, even though the body is in the ground, but there would also be some sort of airspace to block the tumma. But typically, we don't rely on that, and we say that if there is a body buried underneath the ground, that the tumma does go all the way up and go through. The question of tumma in a building and whether the tumah goes out of the room or not, let's say the dead body is in one room, and there's a kohen in another room, does the kohen need to exit the building? So those halachos are somewhat complex. They are relevant today. And a Kohen, if there is a dead body in the building, then the Kohen should leave the building unless they are fully confident that they understand the laws of Tumah and Tara and understand that where they are, the Tumah won't spread. Sometimes that is the case, that the Tumah will not go to where they are, but you have to know the details of Tumah and Tara, and most of the time people are not so proficient in it, so the default would be the Kohen should leave the building, because a Kohen is not allowed to become Tamei Mace. Even if a Kohen becomes Tamei Mace, you might argue, okay, well, he's Tamei already, so what difference does it make? Leaving the building is not going to make him Tahar, so he's Tamei already. It doesn't matter. A Kohen is not allowed to remain in a place where there is a dead body, even if he's already Tamei. So a Kohen who is in an area where there is a dead body, he has to make sure to leave the building. And this is why some hospitals, and a Kohen can't really go to the hospital because there's a morgue in many hospitals, and that can create a problem of Tumah, depending on where the morgue is sitting. Usually the morgue is in the basement, but usually depending on the configuration of the hospital, there is the potential that the Kohen is becoming Tameh for being in the same building, the same ohel, as the mace, as the one who has passed away. Any other questions about this? In today's day and age, most of us are Tamei Mace, as we mentioned, which is fine. You're allowed to be Tamei Mace. And in fact, it is a tremendous mitzvah, as you know. The greatest chesed one can do is with the dead, with the deceased. And that would be to do a tahara and to help with burial, etc. And anybody involved in the Chevra Kadisha becomes Tamei Mace. But that's a badge of honor. That's not a bad thing. It's just that they are Tamei Mace, and therefore they will not be able, when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, they will not be able to go into the Beis HaMikdash until the Parah Aduma is processed. But that's true for most of us. Just about everybody who's been to a funeral is already Tamei, and it never goes away. It can stay on a person for years and years and years and years, and will never go away without the Parah Aduma. So it's nothing to be concerned about. It's just something to be aware of, that we are all Tamei Mace. That's the default. The Kohanim try to avoid it, and they should avoid it. That's the mitzvah of the Torah. Kohen is allowed to become Tamei to his immediate relatives, but other than that, the Kohen is not allowed to become Tamei, and therefore they should try not to. But even so, many Kohanim are Tamei Mace, either because they've come in contact with their immediate relatives after they died, or because they inadvertently became Tamei, and they should therefore remain, but they should still, even though they may be Tamei, they should still stay away from any other potential of continuing or becoming Tamei or coming in contact with a dead body.
So by Prince, a few years ago there was a big jubilation in Eretz Israel. They claimed they had a Parah Aduma.
Yeah, so you never know. It could be they did. You know, you'd have to check it very thoroughly and know what you're doing. The problem is that it doesn't help anybody because we can't process
it. They were excited about it. They were very excited.
Right, so they were excited, I think, because they thought it was a sign that must be Mashiach is coming. Evidently, it's not a sign that Mashiach is coming.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Where do the women who have these children, and I assume they're only boys, not girls, would be boys?
So it's boys only because the girls, even at a young age, could become Tamei. So it would be the boys.
And where did they stay? Did they have a special room in Harbaez?
They must have. They must have had some apartments. They must have had something.
Okay.
We're not talking in the Beis HaMikdash. We're talking just on the complex. Harbaez is a very big place, and in that complex, they had these areas for the women. Right. Okay, now the Parah Aduma, the symbolism of the Parah Aduma, which is what we need to cover now. We don't really have enough time to fully cover that right now, but we'll begin that discussion. The Parah Aduma is clearly to take care of Tumas Mace. That's obviously what it's for. That's the purpose of it. And the Jewish people here are told all about Parah Aduma, and Moshe Rabbeinu did it even in the Midbar, even in the wilderness. He did process a Parah Aduma. However, Chazal tell us that the Para Aduma also is a kapara. It's also an atonement. And it's an atonement for the Egel HaZahav. It's atonement for the golden calf. The Egel HaZahav is a calf. That's a young cow. A Para Aduma is also a cow. It's an adult cow. So the Chazal say a mashal, they say a parable, that if a child soils the paltrin shel melech, the palace of the king, somebody's child soils the palace of the king, the mother of that child has to come and clean up the mess. That's what you'd expect to happen. So Chazal say, here we have a similar idea, that the Egel Hazav is the baby cow that made a mess, that soiled the palace of the king. We Jews, we became soiled because of the Egel Hazav, because of the golden calf. And therefore Hashem says, let the mother of that calf, the Para Aduma, come along and clean up the mess that was made by the Egel Hazav, by the child. That's the symbolism that Chazal tell us. Therefore, there's a lot of symbolism here in Para Aduma that mimics or is the reverse of what happened with the Egel Hazav, with the golden calf. And many aspects of the Para Aduma will correspond to elements of the Egel Hazav. And we're going to go through those elements. In addition to that, we're going to discuss exactly how this works, that you have this Para Aduma atoning for the Egel Hazav. After all, the Para Aduma is for coming in contact with a dead body. The Egel Hazav, although in the Aveira of the Egel Hazav, they did kill Chur. Chur was killed. There was a murder that took place. But the main Aveira of Egel Hazav was not murder. The main Aveira of Egel Hazav was Avodah Zarah, was idolatry. So what is the concept of the Para Aduma, which is for people who came in contact with a dead body? How does that line up with Egel Hazav, with the golden calf? So these are some of the things, Mitzvah Hashem, which we will discuss next time. A little bit early, but we're going to stop here for this evening. Again, I'll pause one more time for any questions. Okay. Everybody should have a great week. Mitzvah Hashem will continue next week.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.